Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What we learned too late about the opioid crisis, still worsening, is that it was not an accident, probably shouldn't have been a surprise. It was the poisoned fruit of a vision that built an empire of pain. Our guest, Patrick Keefe, wrote the book that tracked that vision to a family-owned drug company and to its founder. Arthur Sackler's vision had many dark layers. He knew, to start with, the hurricane force of hunger for narcotic drugs. He knew that in a rich country and a deregulated marketplace, people would spend without limit on what they had to have. He knew the added value of a doctor's prescription on bogus medicine. And he knew that Sackler money could make watchdogs and other nuisances go away, with payoffs as needed. Over 30 or 40 years, Arthur Sackler and his family sold a doctrine of pain, an idea of pain, as something to be managed with a lethal drip line, legal or not. And now, Patrick Keefe, I can't get Arthur Sackler out of my head. He changed our world.
One of the big choices I made in this book was I didn't actually think of it as chiefly an opioid crisis book. And I devoted the first third of the book to the life of Arthur Sackler, this guy who dies in 1987, nearly a decade before the launch of OxyContin. And the reason there was not that he was the eccentric uncle who had the colorful private life and I was just looking to highlight some random family member. I think in some ways he was the mad genius who created the world in which OxyContin and other drugs could end up doing what they did. So you have this guy who is a physician. He grows up during the Great Depression. He venerates doctors. He thinks of doctors as these priest-like figures in society and subscribes to this image of doctors as unimpeachable. At the same time, he goes into medical advertising, into the advertising of pharmaceuticals. And so that's kind of the paradox at the heart of this thing, is that there's medicine and then there's commerce. And what Arthur Sackler is trying to do is break down the walls between the two. And he makes his first great fortune on Librium and Valium, these tranquilizers that became at the time the greatest drugs in the history of the pharmaceutical industry in terms of profitability, and then leads the way for his brothers and subsequent generations to launch OxyContin in the 90s.
Yeah, he's coming alive in the post-war boom of these sort of mood medicines. They're enormously lucrative, productive. He also has pretensions, at least, to care about pain. What is pain? And to theorize about it. Did they tell us anything new or lasting about pain?
You know, interestingly enough, it was really Arthur's nephew, Richard, who pushes the company into pain management specifically. And they didn't. But Richard came along at a time when there was a reconsideration of pain happening in American medicine. I think there was a perception by some doctors that we weren't taking pain seriously enough, that there had been a tendency to just say, oh, you know, the patient can grin and bear it, they can live with pain, thinking of pain more as a symptom of other problems and not a problem in and of itself. And I should say, I think there was some real truth to this. And so you get kind of a revisionist approach. The question then becomes, well, how can we treat pain more aggressively? And the answer that many people came up with was by more broadly prescribing opioids, these powerful painkillers, which a lot of doctors had been reluctant to prescribe out of fears that they were addictive. Part of what was fascinating about Arthur Sackler is he had this very idealistic notion dating back to the 1940s and 50s that someday there would be a pill for every affliction, that the wonders of the kind of pharmaceutical cornucopia are limitless, boundless, and that almost all of these problems are chemical and you can solve them chemically and get rich at the same time. And so that sort of positions the family and the family business to, in the 1980s and 90s, as this reconsideration of pain is happening, say, oh, well, good news, we have these powerful opioids, which actually are the solution to that untreated pain.
Speak of them as people. They're incredibly powerful, but at some level, Patrick, I got to say, they're uninteresting. I can't figure them out, including the endless display of their names eventually on famous museums and universities and whatnot, but intense secrecy about their company.
The paradox that you identify, though, is the one that I was most intrigued by, which is that you have a family which, dating back to the 1950s, has had this kind of mania for putting the family name on art museums and on university buildings. But then the flip side of that is there's been a very assiduous effort to distance the family name from the business, from the source of the money. Mm. When I first started this project, I went to Purdue Pharma's website. This is the family company. And I couldn't find the Sackler name anywhere on the website. So it's this bizarre thing. You go to any major city, chances are you'll find some cultural institution with a Sackler plaque, but there's nothing on the company itself. During the Great Depression, Isaac Sackler, the original patriarch, Arthur's father, he has these three sons. They all grow up to be doctors, but he loses everything in the Depression, and he gathers his sons to him, and he says, I got nothing to give you. You're going to have to pay for your own educations, and I've lost everything. But the one thing I've given you that really means something is I've given you a good family name. And that was a story that was told and retold in this family. Mm. Now, on some level, what the Sacklers were best at, when you asked what did they tell us about pain that we didn't know, most of the really novel things this family did had to do with not with the creation of new products or new drugs, but more with marketing.
Hmm.
I actually think it's kind of fitting that there's been a decades-long project of family branding.
Patrick, did you ever meet a Sackler?
Never did. Nor have I taken OxyContin. I wrote this book from behind the veil of ignorance.
Patrick, you mentioned two key ambitions of his, and they were both very, very subtle, but big changes. One, the advertising of medicines, which was traditionally a no-no, the way you don't advertise or didn't advertise hard liquor on television. You didn't run magazine ads saying, tell your doctor to prescribe you this. And the other thing was opium itself. These are big departures. I wonder if he was clear in his own mind about sort of crossing a big Rubicon socially in every dimension of medical practice.
The big innovation with Arthur Sackler, I think, there are people who worked in medical advertising, these old men who I've interviewed who were in the business in the 50s. Somebody said he invented the wheel when it came to the way in which that business is done.
Hmm.
There were a bunch of things that Arthur did. To me, the most significant was that because of his veneration of physicians, he really recognized that actually the end user, you know, it's nice to reach the consumer if you can.
Right.
You know, any of us who turn on the television at night know that we're inundated with ads for pharmaceuticals now in a way that actually consumers weren't in the 50s and 60s.
Right.
The rules were different back then. But Arthur Sackler realized that what you really need is the physician, that the physician writing the prescription is the person you want to target. And so on the one hand, he would say, oh, physicians, you know, they would never be influenced by something as simple as advertising. On the other hand, he owned and ran an advertising agency geared at persuading physicians to prescribe differently. So I think that was one of his huge innovations. And you see decades later when OxyContin is introduced, a very concerted effort by Purdue and the Sacklers there was a kind of status quo in the American medical establishment when it came to the prescribing of strong opioids. And they decided, we are going to upend that status quo. We are going to take an army of sales reps who aren't doctors and send them out with their persuasive skills and a bunch of what in retrospect was pretty dubious medical literature and a bunch of claims about how these drugs aren't addictive and try and cause a sea change in prescribing. And they were fantastically successful. And to your point about the Rubicon and opioids, it's complicated, right? I mean, all these drugs, they come from the opium poppy.
Right.
And humans have known for thousands of years that the opium poppy has important therapeutic properties, but also is potentially addictive. But I think if you look at the history from morphine to heroin and laudanum and on up through an earlier drug that the Sackler sold, MS-Contin, and then OxyContin, there's been a desire to an almost wishful thinking sense in which you want to kind of favor the therapeutic benefits and say, oh, but look at how this can deliver patients from pain, which is powerful, and then downplay or say, you know, we've cracked it. This new formulation, heroin was marketed by Bayer, right?
Right. And laudanum in its day, Wilkie Collins, absolutely great novelist, wrote The Moonstone. It was about laudanum, but he used giant quantities of it. I'm still puzzling through that it was once sort of there and used, but that the Sacklers would make a concerted, absolutely driven effort to deny its addictive quality. The same way the cigarette companies denied everything they knew about smoking and cancer, it still boggles the mind. That was a very brave bet that they could get away with that.
Well, and they did for decades. They did. Some of them, certainly to judge by the legal papers filed by their lawyers as recently as the last week continue to claim that OxyContin, when used appropriately in a doctor's care, is, it's a rarity, 1 or 2% of the time, that people become addicted. Now, there aren't many people at this stage who believe that, who aren't members of the Sackler family or in their employ or people who work at Purdue Pharma, but that's still a case they make. The key, though, to your point about laudanum and how we might all be using it, is these drugs have never gone away. There's a whole other conversation about drug prohibition and the stigma associated with that. I know from interviewing many people who've had their lives upended by these drugs, in which they say, I would never have gone out on the street and bought heroin and then snorted it or shot it into my arm. There was an on-ramp for me, which is that a doctor prescribed me these FDA-approved opioid pills. Mm. And that's much more approachable. The level of inhibition is just totally different when it comes to taking that kind of drug. And then what happened is that a lot of people found that there was a kind of undertow that pulls them in, and they're dependent and they're addicted. And if they stop using, they're going to experience terrible withdrawal. And at that point, somebody offers you heroin, and the calculus is different than it was before.
Yeah. I had a tooth implant, and when it was over, rather minor surgery, the dentist handed me a slip of paper that said, OxyContin. I said, what in the world? Do you read the papers? Do you have any idea? I'm amazed that it's still going on. This business about saying, you know, administered by a doctor with care, et cetera, is not addictive, seems to me just such a ruse. If taken apart, if snorted, if sold on the street, if it leads to fentanyl, it's a death sentence. That should be part of the same pitch.
Long before I wrote about the Sackler family, I did a great deal of work on the illicit drug market in this country and the Mexican drug cartels. And I'm not a drug prohibitionist. I've looked pretty closely at the consequences of drug prohibition. So my perspective on this is not that OxyContin should never have been developed or sold. It's all about marketing and how widely you market it and how honestly you market it. So my position even today would not be that we need to pull these drugs from the shelves. It's just be straight with consumers about what you're selling them.
Coming up, telltale American slogans. No pain, no gain in the gym. Better living through chemistry in a pinch. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The Sackler family advantage in the drug marketplace was their hand in both supply and demand. They were making their knockout pills and also pumping consumption with their advertising agency and their publications. Kathleen Friedel is the historian I asked to explain a voracious appetite for risky drugs. Her last book recounted the drug wars in America. Her essay forthcoming on the origins of the opioid crisis is titled The Pharma Cartel. So, what does the opioid crisis say about us as consumers? We're a rich society, Kathleen Friedel says, with a divided mind about pain.
In this country, we have an unrealistic idea regarding pain. That pain is something that we shouldn't not have. Our body should be strong enough to not have pain. We shouldn't be suffering pain. Rather than, you know, pain is a part of life. It's an integral signal. You know, I speak as somebody who has chronic pain, and when my pain gets worse, my body's telling me something. Instead, we think about pain as something that should just go away, and we want to take a pill for it to go away. So as far as American culture goes and what fuels demand, there's many, many currents in operation. And for something as catastrophic as the opioid crisis, I would say each and every single one of those plays a part in this story. The affluence, the abandonment, the mental illness that goes untreated, and the kind of unrealistic ideals we have about pain.
Kathleen, that's fascinating. There are two threads there that I love you both to pursue. The good news that you're saying is that these tides, these crises come and go. Maybe this one will die a natural death, but I want to know how they do die. But secondly, your own point that you have been through a lot of pain and learned how to deal with it. We've got to learn a lot more about pain, including the resistance to anesthesia when it first appeared. There is a love of pain as well as a terrible, terrible fear and reality of pain. What's the path to understanding the better ways to deal with it? It is the oldest medical complaint. Doctor, I'm hurting in some fashion. We know cancer pain, existential pain. What's to do, really, if we take it seriously?
Well, unfortunately, my optimism is going to turn to some pessimism here because we have certain incentives built into our healthcare system, which is a very unusual healthcare system. I mean, we have a totally private healthcare system with some public audiences carved into it like Medicare, but we have a very unusual healthcare system where we look to it not necessarily to care for people, we look to it to make a profit. There are certain features of the American medical system, the high volume of patients, the short visits, looking at cost before effectiveness. There are certain features that have not gone anywhere and greatly exacerbated the opioid crisis. You mentioned my own experience with pain. I know that for a lot of pain patients, there is an upfront expense involved in a careful, detailed patient history. And there's also follow-up involved where you try certain things, they work, you try other things, they don't work. It's an experimental pursuit. It's not just pop a pill and it will go away. So there's an upfront expense involved in treating pain patients in an integrated, holistic way. And our healthcare system is very, very bad at it, regardless of the fact that, you know, write a prescription, pop a pill, that actually might produce more costs down the line. It certainly produces more human costs, but it might also produce more financial costs down the line. But there are certain incentives built into our healthcare system that we haven't really properly reckoned with. And so for that reason, we can expect that the opioid crisis is going nowhere fast. We can also expect that the policy failures that led to the opioid crisis, and you mentioned the deregulation. I know Patrick mentioned the kind of failed policy incentives built into drug prohibition. Well, as of right now, we are not doing anything to course correct, for example, at the Food and Drug Administration. There hasn't been any fundamental change to the process, nor has there been any change to the institutional culture of the FDA that approved OxyContin on the basis of, as Patrick said, very dubious evidence and expanded it to a new market to treat chronic pain in the absence of evidence that it was effective in any way to treat chronic pain. Those decisions, you know, could be made tomorrow because the FDA has yet to seriously grapple with the policy failures of the opioid crisis. And unfortunately, drug prohibition is not going anywhere. Criminal cartels in Mexico know that they can produce an abundance of heroin and now fentanyl and find a ready market for it on the streets of the United States. It's interesting to me that you raise this question of the policy failures because here we are in the midst of a global pandemic. And many Americans have wondered and really demanded that the government answer for its policy failures. And yet, many of those kinds of mistakes, many of the same public health mistakes, in fact, in some cases, many of the same people played a role in the opioid crisis, but we have no parallel demand. There's no demand that the institutions of the United States and what you could only describe as not just a system failure, as Patrick said, but a regulatory collapse.
Yeah. And it's fascinating. We get to know that phrase, safe and effective, when they were screening vaccines and treatments for COVID. Safe and effective is the basic FDA formula, and they have never been pushed or pushed themselves to rule on whether addictive opioids are safe and effective as a treatment for pain. I mean, it's incredible. Patrick, come back to some of the points that Kathleen has just made there about medicine as a big piece of our consumer capitalism in this country today. How much of that, the making a big, big business out of hospitals, insurance, and medicine, and doctors, how much of that should be, could be attributed to the Sacklers?
A non-trivial part of it, but of course, this is a whole system. I mean, we can't lay this all at the doorstep of this family. I do think that in terms of pain in particular, you know, I think the critique that the American medical establishment hadn't really thought enough about pain was actually right on some level, and that you would have doctors who went to medical school and didn't really learn much about the treatment of pain. What happens, though, is that because our system is the way it is, and this is an area in which Purdue did play a real leadership role, when that education comes, it comes via the drug companies. It comes via pharmaceutical companies that have a heavy incentive to sell these opioids. And so you get this situation in which when OxyContin was first promoted and the FDA signed off on it, you know, the tag phrase they used was, it's the drug to start with and the drug to stay with. And they meant two things there. There's two parts of that, and we should think about them separately. The drug to start with meant, this is not some nuclear solution that you graduate to when other courses of treatment fail. This is the first line of defense against pain, and not just against really severe end-of-life pain or cancer pain, but even moderate pain. I mean, not just severe chronic pain, but just moderate pain.
Right.
So they were saying, you know, start early. It's the one to start with, and it's the one to stay with. So the argument of the company, and I should say, I think the Sacklers and Purdue would probably continue to argue this today, was that you can just keep taking it year in, year out, forever, with no adverse consequences. Now, anybody who knows about opioids knows that they have a few properties. One is that they're very habit-forming. Even people who you wouldn't necessarily classify as addicted can become physiologically dependent to the point where if they stop taking the drug, they go into terrible withdrawal. Importantly, if you're a pain patient and you're going into withdrawal, one symptom of your withdrawal is an intensification of the pain that put you on the drug in the first place. And then additionally, your body builds up a tolerance to opioids, so you need to keep upping the dose in order to maintain equilibrium. Now, from a business point of view, this is fantastic. What a great scenario. People start taking your drug, they take it indefinitely. If they stop taking it, they go into terrible pain and feel an intensification of the symptoms that got them on the drug in the first place. Oh, and by the way, they need to keep increasing the dose, and the way the drug is priced by volume, that's more and more profit for you. For the patient, I think it becomes really, really difficult. And for the medical establishment, the problem is that you had a whole generation of doctors who basically learned to put people on these drugs, and they learned it from the pharma companies. And what the pharma companies didn't teach them was, how do you take people off?
I'm still trying to figure the Sackler fingerprint on our whole system. But, you know, take, for example, the quick prescription that Kathleen spoke of, the pop a pill, no deeper consideration, no partnership in working with the pain problem. That's pure Sackler. I also think, you know, once upon a time I was an orderly in a hospital. We did vital signs twice a day, twice a shift, you know, temperature, respiration rate, and pulse. Today, the vital signs include, how's your pain? And rate it on a scale of 1 to 10. That seems to me an immensely mischievous question. If you say 2, they keep walking. If you say 4, the response has to be, well, we've got a pill for that. Would you like it? Would you like to try it?
Well, and the tricky thing is, it's totally subjective. My wife, who is an athlete and runs marathons and has a more stoic personality than I do, you know, a 9 for me is a 6 for her.
Right. And either way, do you want an opioid to deal with it? That question really doesn't even get debated in the new system. Would you like some OxyContin at a low level?
It is increasingly becoming something that physicians think about. You know, the CDC issued these guidelines a number of years ago. This is an issue that gets debated. There's really two questions, right? Is when do you start people on these drugs? And I think there's much more caution now than there was 10 or 15 years ago by physicians in terms of when they start prescribing these drugs. Mm. And then there's also this question of, you know, do you taper people off? And so it's complicated because there's, on the one hand, there, you know, the CDC and others have said there's no real evidence that these drugs work for chronic pain over a long period of time. At the same time, I get emails almost every day from chronic pain patients who say, who are quite angry with me. And they say, I mean, I should say generally they haven't read the book, but they'll say, I see you're writing a book about the Sacklers. You're stigmatizing OxyContin. I rely on these drugs to live my life. If they're taken away from me, I might commit suicide because of the pain. You do have this kind of strange sense in which there's a community of people, chronic pain patients, who've been kind of marooned by the pendulum swing of the medical establishment and are worried now that there will be an overcorrection and they won't have access to these drugs. Some people looking at a scenario like the one I just described would say, these are people who actually should be tapered because really what's, you know, what they're afraid of is the withdrawal of going off of the opioids. It's not their underlying pain. Other doctors would say, no, that's not true. In fact, they have found a way to live their lives comfortably taking these drugs week in, week out.
How many emails do you get, Patrick, of the other sort from people saying, my son, my brother, my mother
every day
died of opioids and you got to do something about it? It's not about pain. It's about some much deeper inadequacy, yearning for relief, and saying that opioids are a huge mistake. I mean, how do you weigh those two?
I get them every day. Yeah. But it's hard because you do get these two different types of testimonials, and these communities, I think, almost never talk to one another. And there's another aspect of this that we haven't talked about, which is that the when the Sacklers first and their company, Purdue Pharma, first started hearing that there were problems with the drug, that people were abusing it and becoming addicted, they sort of posited this notion that there's two kinds of people. There's legitimate pain patients who take the drugs as prescribed by their doctors, and they're very responsible, and they never have any problems. And then there's drug abusers who are kind of reckless people who've made bad choices in their lives, and if they weren't abusing OxyContin, they'd be abusing something else. And this, I think, is a deeply pernicious idea that taps into a whole series of American myths about kind of self-reliance and personal choice and pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But so what's so unsettling for me is that I get emails from the pain patients who often will tell me about their own conditions, which sound harrowing, but will then say, I'm responsible. I take my medicine responsibly. Why are these other people ruining it for me? And I think that underestimates the role that the drugs themselves can have in causing addiction. And on the other hand, I'm getting, you know, notes from parents who say, you know, my child had surgery and was given a prescription and got hooked in a doctor's care.
Yeah, I would send both sorts to Kathleen to say, tell me how I deal with this, not with destructive narcotics.
So we do have an issue of legacy pain patients. So I'm speaking here of the patient population to whom opioids were prescribed unproblematically, and they still are taking pain pills to alleviate their suffering. There's not a single regulation that touches them. Every single state regulation keeps their pain dispensing in place. But very often, doctors, very subjective people, operate by signal. And so the CDC's recommendations, which keep their prescribing intact, nevertheless, when the CDC expresses well-founded skepticism regarding the utility of opioids to treat chronic pain, a lot of doctors will second-guess themselves and start to walk their opioid prescribing back. And one of the problems that Patrick identified, and it's just mind-boggling, what business do you have prescribing opioids when you don't know how to taper? Tapering is a very difficult thing to manage. You can't just reduce doses. You have to monitor a patient very, very closely. It's an involved process. There are guidelines to tapering. They're not really widespread. So what business do a lot of doctors have prescribing opioids when they were never taught how to taper? It's sort of like, did you envision this pain patient being on this pill forever? And of course, the Sacklers family's answer would be, Yes, we did. I want to walk back to the Sacklers specifically, because I actually don't consider them, by necessity, more evil than others. They had many fellow travelers, many enablers. Johnson & Johnson is a pharmaceutical giant without whom we would not have the opioid crisis, because they made possible the raw materials that the Sacklers and others used to manufacture their drugs. So I think of them as, one in a group, and they might be distinguished, but I think the characteristics which distinguish them are that they're just particularly skilled. And they're skilled at one thing, which is the direct-to-physician marketing. The pharmaceutical industry spends more money on marketing than it does on research and development. This is an industry that spends more on its sales force than any other U.S. industry. So this is an industry that's very aware that the missions that they're sending out to the individual doctor's office, what they call detailing, is a highly, highly effective mechanism to drive their sales. But they also do something else. And I want to mention this in the context of Patrick's letters that he receives. They also donate a ton of money to health advocacy organizations or patient advocacy groups. And we have within this economic sector, this pharmaceutical industry, we have this issue of what's called unbranded advocacy.
They called it the pain movement.
Exactly.
As if it were almost a religion.
Right. And first, the zealotry which, that Patrick gets on his emails on a daily basis would suggest that for some it is. And I can tell you that if I post something that's skeptical about opioid use for chronic pain on Twitter, I can be sure that I will hear from, I don't know if they're real people, I don't know what's going on, but I will hear from people, because actually human beings respond to this. Doctors respond to somebody bringing donuts to their office. Surprisingly enough, that will drive pharmaceutical sales. Someone on Twitter, if they know posting a message will earn them some kind of castigation, they will be less likely. So in a way, the Sacklers' genius, and if you want to call it an evil genius because of the consequences, I think that's, justified. But their genius really was in understanding human nature and extending that understanding to doctors themselves.
Coming up, the question of justice. Who pays for catastrophe? This is Open Source. Patrick Radden Keefe's new book is called Empire of Pain. Kathleen Friedel wrote The Drug Wars in America. Kathleen Friedel and Patrick Keefe, I want to talk about the lasting effects, and not just medical, of this whole opioid era. The damage to all of us on top of the deaths. The subtler effects of the saga. I would say it includes this fog of finance and profit, new in my lifetime, but all the pressure around medicine that has overtaken our experience of doctoring. Where do you begin, Patrick, in the sort of effects this has had on the way we think and talk and organize and live our lives?
A lot of what I was doing in the book was looking at the history, particularly in the 1950s and 60s. And there were physicians at the time who saw what was happening and were gravely worried. They just worried that you'd get the development of this economic juggernaut that would be so powerful that it would overwhelm the Hippocratic precepts of the field. And I think it happened. Now the genie is clearly out of the bottle, but it was poignant for me to look back at some of these articles in medical journals and people speaking out in testimony as far back as the 1950s as it was happening in real time and saying, this is not good. There's someone I quote in the book talking about how the doctor is sort of trying to make his or her decisions amid the clamor of commerce. It gets very hard to do the right thing. That's our world now. And I don't know that this is unique to the medical sector at all, right? This is true of our justice system and our regulatory apparatus. The almighty dollar wins again and again.
Yeah, we see it in our universities, other institutions that used to be kind of church-like. They're now just biz.
Yes.
Dominated by their giant contributors, incredibly pricey.
Well, and it's funny that we haven't really touched on this, but there's an issue, a kind of controversy related to the Sacklers, in which because of all that naming, you now have all these institutions that are starting to take the name down, and in many instances under pressure. Tufts University in Massachusetts, NYU most recently peeled the Sackler name away from a series of institutes. There's pressure on the Metropolitan Museum of Art and others to take the name down. I've had conversations with people at universities and art museums who look at this development with real trepidation, because what they'll say privately is, good Lord, you know, if we start subjecting our board of trustees to some ethical litmus test, we won't have any trustees left.
Horrible thought. Let me change the subject. What could be called justice at the end of the Sackler story? Purdue agreed at one point to pay the state of Oklahoma damages at $270 million for one state. It would have been multi-billions for the whole country, but they abandoned that. They wanted a global settlement. That has now been tied up at the end of the Trump administration into a very minor slap on the wrist. What will or won't constitute justice at the end of this horrible story?
It's a tricky thing, because OxyContin has generated $35 billion in revenue since it was introduced in 1996, but Purdue Pharma is in bankruptcy at the moment. And if you're trying to figure out how those two things could be true, the answer is that the family that owns Purdue, the Sacklers, have been very carefully pulling billions and billions and billions of dollars out of the company for years. We know that they've pulled at least $10 billion and likely much more than that in just the last decade or so. So you end up in this kind of crazy situation in which the company is in bankruptcy with hardly any money left, and people are kind of fighting over the corpse. And the Sacklers are on the sidelines with their fortune intact. Most people looking at this situation would say that's not a very satisfying outcome. And the Sacklers have proposed a deal in which they would pay $4.25 billion to try and wrap up all of these cases and shield themselves from any further litigation while admitting no wrongdoing whatsoever.
Meantime, this is an incredible proposal that keep Purdue, the shell of it, in the opioid business and use those profits not to go to the Sacklers, but to go to the states for running their opioid recovery programs. I mean, how weird could that be?
It'll cross your eyes. It's, I think, very hard from the outside to understand. There are many, many moments in this story where I think a bunch of high-priced lawyers sit around in a room and come up with an idea that they all think is brilliant. And it often doesn't pass the emperor's new clothes test. And that would definitely be one of them. Basically, the states will now own Purdue Pharma and will be incentivized to sell more OxyContin in order to generate funds to deal with the opioid crisis.
To pay for their rehabilitation centers or something.
Yeah. So I should say roughly half of the states, including Massachusetts, Maura Healey, the Attorney General of Massachusetts, resisted this proposal. She is a hero in this story, and she has said, you know, it shouldn't work that way. This is a company that pled guilty to criminal charges twice, most recently in 2020. You kind of have a situation in which the company pleads guilty to criminal charges over this long period of time. It's basically a criminal enterprise. The family that owns the company pulls all the money out of the company, faces no personal liability, and kicks the company into bankruptcy. So she's saying either these suits against the family should be allowed to go forward and just see where they go, and the family can defend themselves on the merits, or the family's going to have to give up more of their fortune and perhaps actually acknowledge some wrongdoing.
Let me say before we're done, Patrick, you're one of the heroes of this story, to my mind. Just to keep your cool, not be too righteous or outraged in the patient research of this whole history. You also did it, you wrote it, a lot of it, in COVID isolation. I wonder what connections you made in your head or your practice between these two totally different but somehow related medical embarrassments.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I mean, writing the story of a slow-moving medical catastrophe that unfolds over the course of 25 years in the midst of a fast-moving medical catastrophe. For me, there's an awkwardness in publishing my book at this moment, because there's, I think, a natural and important skepticism about the motivations of Big Pharma. At the same time, I wouldn't want that to translate into, you know, vaccine hesitancy or, you know, people doubting the fact that the FDA has approved the vaccine. So it's bizarre for me to publish a book in which I describe Pfizer paying bribes to the head of antibiotics at the FDA during the 1950s. literally the book came out between my two shots of the Pfizer vaccine.
Oh my God. Let me just say, it seems to me the key event, the Sackler keystroke, might have been getting the FDA to approve addictive, lethal OxyContin heroin in a pill in the first place. David Kessler, who was running the FDA when it happened, said later that destigmatizing opioids was one of the great mistakes of modern medicine. Who's going to pay for that mistake?
I think it's the public. I think it's you and me. It's the people who've struggled with these drugs and their families. It's the overtaxed medical system. And I don't think it will be the main perpetrators. I think there's something of a legal reckoning coming for some of these other companies, Johnson & Johnson among them. But when you look at the magnitude of the damage, any price that is extracted from these companies, I think it'll be a drop in a bucket.
Kathleen, what stands out as the worst mistake in a miserable saga?
We still are a country that prescribes opioids for chronic pain in the absence of evidence to a degree that no other country approaches. So we can productively focus attention on the Sacklers. But I want to enlarge our sense of what justice means. For me, it has very little to do with the Sacklers and the Purdue Pharma bankruptcy case. I think the only clear winners in the Purdue Pharma bankruptcy case are the lawyers who will make a lot of money on both sides trying that case or hearing that case. So for me, justice looks a little bit different than any price that might be exacted from the Sacklers or Purdue Pharma specifically. For me, justice looks a lot more like the vaccine trials, which Patrick mentioned, which were, you know, randomized control trials, running those kinds of medical gold standards for pain patients. Pain patients deserve that. Pain patients, we deserve to know what works for our pain. And we have yet to see the FDA commit to running those kinds of trials, despite the fact that the National Academy of Sciences has recommended that they run randomized control trials for opioids and chronic pain twice now, and the FDA has resisted that. So we are still in a place where our government regulatory agencies are failing us. They have not returned to prioritizing the needs of ordinary Americans or safeguarding ordinary Americans over and above corporate profits. You could call it deregulation, you could call it privatization, austerity politics. Generally speaking, these things are grouped under this larger heading of neoliberalism and includes one or more of these things. But what we have now is a government where we've offered different parts of it, including regulatory approval processes for sale. And we, as an American people, need to take those processes back. And that's what justice would look like for me.
Speak, Kathleen, of the pharma money in everyday campaigns for the House, the Senate, local politics for that matter.
Yeah, state and local politics should be counted too. So we have organizations that track that, like Open Secrets. And what we find year after year, I think starting in the late 1990s, which is actually when the opioid crisis started, what we find is the pharmaceutical industry, so it's formally called the pharmaceutical and health products industry, spends more on lobbying as an industry than any other sector of the American economy. And it's not just by a little, it's by a lot. They actually double the amount of
more spending, than oil, more than banking,
more than all of those things. And they actually double the amount of spending of their number two. So it's not even a close call. So when we are talking about the mistakes that led to the opioid crisis, and I'm speaking here about the policy failures and particularly the regulatory failures. How did this much raw material get imported? How did this drug get approved for a use that was never tested? How did these things happen? There's no way to offer a responsible answer to that question without pointing to the incredible influence that the pharmaceutical industry has.
What are they asking these politicians to do once they're bought nowadays?
What they're asking them to do is keep drug prices in the, I hate to call it the free market, because what we have right now is not exactly a free market, but in any way, keep drug prices away from direct government regulation. But just as important when it comes to the opioid crisis are the things that they ask them not to do. And so it's a rarity in the United States Senate, for example, to have a senator who is knowledgeable and active on the opioid crisis. We do have them. I don't want to dismiss the entire institution, Maggie Hassan, Joe Manchin. There are senators who are very active and educated on the opioid crisis. And not surprisingly, they all call for changes within the FDA. But by and large, you're talking about a half a dozen senators here. And so it's been a bipartisan failure that's led to the catastrophe of the opioid crisis. But what's also true is that the market that the Sacklers created, so this kind of chronic pain market that then flipped over to a recreational market, is also the reason why Mexican criminal cartels upped their production of heroin. And in particular, they moved into the production of white powder heroin. Mm. So what we're talking about here is a sequence of two things. The first is, how is it that the Sacklers came to look at doctors and see a drug dealer? And we've spent a lot of this hour talking about that. But there's a second step, and that is, once they did that, that made it possible for somebody like El Chapo Guzman, you know, running the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico, to look at the United States and see an untapped heroin market. So it's been a series of cascading failures that got us to this place of nearly 100,000 opioid overdoses. But it's possible that we're not going to see those numbers walk back anytime soon. I hate to say it because the numbers are so staggering. But like I say, these policy failures, like drug prohibition and like the regulatory collapse at the FDA, they have been locked into place. And so far, we don't have a lot of politicians looking to change those things.
What's to say about the synthetic knockoff, but incredibly lethal, powerful fentanyl?
Yeah, you know, so the opioid crisis can be divided into three stages. The first is the licit opioid stage, and that's what, you know, Patrick and I have been speaking about. And then somewhere around 2009, the Mexican cartels went very heavily into black tar heroin and brown powder heroin, and started to plant poppies, which would ultimately result in white powder heroin. So we have a heroin phase of the opioid crisis, and that was about from 2009 to 2013. And since 2013, it's actually become much more of a story of fentanyl, which is a synthetic opioid. And a lot of fentanyl is manufactured illicitly in China. And recently, we have learned that Mexican cartels have obtained the ability to manufacture it in Mexico itself. Now, and this is stunning, it's stunning for me even to say these words and share this with your audience, but now what we find is actually fentanyl is totally displacing heroin. It's not just adulterating heroin. The opioids on the street right now are so powerful that they're very often primarily fentanyl, and the chances of your overdose and death are extremely high. So it's an escalating crisis, and the drugs are just getting stronger and stronger. And yet, as a political system, at this late date, we still do not have the capacity to hit the pause button and say, as Patrick poses in his book, how did we get here? What are the system failures that brought us to this moment?
Kathleen, a last word on the doctors, what they've done with the prescriptions, what they're doing to chart another way. 100 billion pills have been prescribed by American doctors. What must they do as a damaged body of professionals themselves to find another way?
So if I were in the medical profession right now, I would be endorsing the recommendations of the National Academies of Science and asking the FDA to review opioids as a treatment for chronic pain wholesale. I mean, I don't think we can make good recommendations about opioid use until we have better science about what opioid use over time does for chronic pain patients and what it fails to do. They have not added their endorsement of that recommendation to the discussion. And that's not surprising to me because as a historian, when you look at the history of the American Medical Association, what you find is an organization that's most often an obstacle to change and progress. So this is an organization that opposed national health insurance under Harry Truman. They opposed Medicare under Lyndon Johnson. This is an organization that is a professional guild, essentially, and they will defend their guild prerogatives and particularly their autonomy over and above caring about any particular bad outcomes. So it's very much like the police, where our attention is drawn to a few bad apples, when in fact, it's the police insistence on autonomy and freedom from civilian oversight that makes these bad apples possible, if you will. We have yet to have that kind of structural epiphany with the medical profession.
Patrick Keith, the last word.
No, I mean, I think that's a point very well taken.
Thank you, Patrick and Kathleen. It's been an incredibly challenging hour. Challenging book, too. Thanks for that, Patrick.
It's been really fascinating speaking with you both. Thank you, Kathleen, for doing this. And thank you, Chris, for having me.
Kathleen Friedel, we're not done with this subject, but we thank you for teaching us so much.
Thank you so much, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from Michael Garth. Mary McGrath monitors our pain thresholds. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.